Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Joe Sorge, and I'd like to tell you about a breakthrough study coming out of the University of California that reveals some shocking facts related to our child support system.
We all know that divorce is contentious, but why the long, drawn-out battles over custody? These battles pit one parent against the other and put the children in the middle.
In most cases, both parents want to see their children, and except under rare circumstances, do the children not want to see both parents.
So what if the parents simply share the children? Well, you guessed it, money.
If child support levels are set too low, the children may not get proper housing or food or clothing. But if child support levels are set too high, the payer may not be able to afford the payments.
And under our current system, if a payer falls behind on payments, a warrant may be issued for their arrest. And if they're arrested, their driver's licenses are taken away and they're put in jail, where they can't work and make money to catch up on their payments. So it's a vicious cycle and nobody wins.
We believe that this University of California study reveals for the first time the true costs of raising children and uncovers damning evidence that our current child support calculations unnecessarily fuel custody battles.
So we sat down with the brilliant economist, Dr. William Komonarth, the main author of this study. He's professor of economics at the University of California and once served as the chief economist of the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity to do this.
I'm delighted.
So if it costs $500 a month to raise a child in the state of Alabama, does every parent pay $500 a month?
No, the state can set different amounts for wealthier parents than poorer parents. Can set different amounts if there's two children or three children as opposed to one child in the household. So the states have lots of flexibility. But however they do it, they must pay attention to available data on the economic cost of raising children.
Can an economist determine what it costs to raise a child?
Yes. Suppose you have two households with pretty much the same income levels and the same general standards of living. And one of these households might have one child and another household might be childless. And then one can compare the household with a child with the household without the child and try to examine with available data, did the household with the child spend more on housing, more on food, more on clothing, more on child care and education, more on other different elements of expenditures. Suppose it's true that a household is composed of a husband and a wife and no children, and they live in a two-bedroom apartment, and they use the second bedroom as a den. Now, suppose child arrives and the den is transformed into a nursery. Let's compare the two circumstances. Well, given my hypothetical example, notice there is no change in housing costs. They spent the same amount on rent when the child arrives as they spent originally. They stay in the same unit. For the most part, your child lives in your household and, you know, consumes the same collection of goods that you consume.
Do people that have their first child spend more on food?
Generally, no. They spend the same amount on food despite the presence of the first child than they spend earlier.
If you have another mouth eating, how could you possibly not spend more on food?
You probably throw away less. Suppose it was true before the presence of children, you would eat out a lot. And we all know that food in restaurants is expensive. And when the child arrives, you eat at home more. So there may be some redistribution within the categories. I don't doubt that. But your total outlays, you know, don't appear to be that much different in the presence of a child than before.
Dr. Komonarth's approach measures what is typically called marginal cost increases. For example, an automobile does not burn much more gasoline with two people sitting in it than it does with just one person sitting in it. The cost of the extra fuel consumed would be called the marginal cost of adding a second passenger. If we dig into the details of Dr. Komonarth's publication, we find that the increase in food expense is, in fact, very low when children are young. But as the children age, food costs go up significantly.
This might lead one to believe that child support amounts should be increased as the children age. However, Dr. Komenor's data also reveal a counterbalancing trend. Parents spend less on child care services as the children age. While these two factors do not offset each other exactly, and the results vary somewhat in different economic brackets, total marginal expenses do not change substantially as children get older.
How many households did you study? We looked at over 16,000 households to do these comparisons.
Your control group had no children?
That's correct.
And then the group that you were measuring the increase in expenditures had one, two, three, or more children?
We did it in three different circumstances, with one child, with two children, and with three children.
I asked Dr. Komenor if others had published on this topic before he and his co-authors did. He said yes, there are two other published methods, but neither looks at out-of-pocket marginal costs.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture annually publishes a report on the cost of raising children. And what's striking is that they use the same data that I use. We all use the same data.
But he said that the USDA method is flawed because it simply takes certain expenditure categories and divides those costs by the number of individuals in the family, including the children. This is called the average costs method as opposed to the out-of-pocket marginal costs method. I asked him to give us an example of why his method comes up with a more realistic measure of transportation costs than the USDA method.
The household had two cars before the arrival of children and now has two cars still. And for the most part, they say they spend the same amount of money on cars and gasoline and all of that stuff. And the cars had a back seat before, which wasn't generally used. And now it's used with the child. So there's essentially no additional transportation cost. The real transportation cost is the cost of the car seat.
He went on to explain that the USDA method is also flawed with respect to housing costs.
They said that the housing cost of the child is the cost of an additional bedroom. So if originally you had a two-bedroom apartment, one used with a den, then the housing cost would be the hypothetical rental cost of a three-bedroom apartment where you could keep your den even if that was never used. So again, that was a fiction.
We then talked about a second competing method for studying the costs of raising children, called the income equivalence, or IE method. The IE method is used by a private consulting firm that advises many of the states regarding child support levels.
They measure the welfare of a household in terms of the proportion spent on alternatively food or adult clothing. And then it tries to ask whether or not in the presence of the child you spent less on adult clothing or food than you did otherwise.
Sound complicated? Well, that's because it is. Let us try to explain the convoluted approach taken by the IE method.
The IE method assumes that fewer dollars are spent on adult food and adult clothing so that money could be made available for the needs of the children. The method then assumes that a similar shifting of expenses will occur in other cost categories as well, such as for transportation and housing costs. But the IE method does not measure those shifting expenses directly. Instead, it makes the questionable assumption that parents will give up the same proportion or percentage of their income in other expense categories as they did for adult food and clothing. So it multiplies that same percentage times the family's other expenses to compute a synthetic amount. It then assumes that a custodial parent would need this synthetic amount in order to raise children under a lifestyle that also affords that custodial parent all the things they enjoyed prior to having children.
They're trying to assign a value to keeping the old lifestyle, even though you're living with a child and you don't follow the old lifestyle.
You may not even want the old
lifestyle.
That's
exactly right. You may not even want the old lifestyle, but that's not taken into account in these other methods. It's a bizarre approach, I believe.
I asked Dr. Komenor for some examples of what types of hypothetical reductions in the standard of living might be computed in the IE method's synthetic amount.
Food costs are largely often restaurant meals out, and some people want to have very high fashion clothing and some do not. We all know that once you have a child, your whole life changes, and you have focus on your children in a way that you never did before. But the methodology used in this IE method ignores that reality.
Does the IE method measure the value to parents of having a child?
No, it doesn't.
I've read that some of these IE methods actually measure the amount of tobacco and alcohol consumed by the adults.
Yes, they do. Isn't that bizarre? And yet, that approach is the dominant approach today, used today, by which child support guideline amounts are determined.
Why?
The reason is because when the states got into this business back in the 1980s, there was no data on the child expenditures, there were data on household expenditures. And so they needed to find a way to go from available data for the household to that which it applies to the child.
Did the IE method look at single parents with children?
No, they did not. They only looked at married households.
What about the USDA method? Did they look at single parents?
Yes, they did. They did look at single parents as well as married parents.
And did you look at single parents?
Yes, I did.
Because one could argue that the single parent with a child is the more relevant economic situation than the married or the couple with or without children.
That's exactly right. The costs of raising a child or children in a single-headed household are slightly greater than on average than those in a married household.
You're basically saying that people spend less on children than these other methods estimate they spend on children.
Yes, substantially less. And the reason is because our method is limited to out-of-pocket expenditures. You know, direct
real money.
Real money. What the other methods do is attribute expenditures to children which are not made out-of-pocket. It's a fiction.
Well, let's take a look at the costs estimated by the IE and USDA methods and compare them to the costs measured by Dr. Kolmenor's method. For married households, the IE method overestimated the cost of raising a child by about 200%, and the USDA method overestimated the cost by roughly 300%. The overestimates were even more extreme for single-parent households. While the IE method did not even look at single-parent households, the USDA method overestimated expenses by over 300% for low-income households and over 400% for mid- to high-income households. These overestimates have been misleading the states into setting child support awards that are too high, by somewhere between $400 and $800 per month per child. Over the course of a child's dependency, that could amount to nearly $100,000 per child of unsupported costs for low-income families and nearly $200,000 per child of unsupported costs for middle-income families. This begs the question of whether the $120 billion of unpaid child support in the United States today is due to parents' unwillingness to make child support payments, or are the amounts so high that they cannot afford to make them? Essentially, there is a profit in being a custodial parent.
That's exactly right. That's what the current child support system does.
Do you think that this profit factor that exists in the guidelines now can cause non-optimal behavior?
For the child support system to work effectively, it must have the agreement of both parents, not only the recipient, but the payer. And the payers recognize that the amount of money that they are obligated to pay exceeds actual expenditures on the child, they know that. They're not saying they live it. And so what the payers are funding is not merely the cost of raising their children, but also a financial asset which benefits the recipient. And of course, that creates discord between the parents. The payer objects, and the recipient feels entitled to it, which would not be true if the child support award amounts truly reflected the out-of-pocket costs of raising children.
And is there a venue where this discord gets played out?
In the courts. In divorce courts.
This is one of the most contentious areas of family law, and the unfortunate truth is that children are paying the price for a flawed system. If you would like to see your state review its child support guidelines, please contact your state legislators. and let them know that children should not be used as pawns in an economic battle involving their parents and their lawyers. I hope that with your help, we can work toward reducing the conflicts inherent in our family court system. I'm Joe Sorge. Thank you for watching.
Neglect, and addiction enter the picture. Many times, these are convenient charges against innocent family members guilty of illness even after the partner left. I heard many unwed fathers tell me that they begged the mothers of their children to marry them, but that the mothers were unwilling to give up the welfare check in exchange for a husband and father in the home. The most outdated picture of the father leaving the mom and kids to run off with his secretary is all but a thing of the past. In Southwest Michigan, 98% of the divorces are initiated by mothers and unwanted by the father. These aren't abusive fathers either. Equal parenting is not a men's issue. I was a single mother for most of my children's lives, and I know what children need most is the love and balance two fit parents can give them. Money can never make up for the loss of a parent. Divorce or separation should not be the reason some kids will never get to know one important part of themselves. Equal parenting does not do away with child support. Child support takes on a whole new dimension for children with two loving parents instead of just one. I am humble as I stand in the shadows of one of our greatest founding fathers. Here in this place, another great father, Martin Luther King, announced to the world that he had a dream. Well, Mahatma Gandhi told us that we must be the change that we want to see in the world. Are you willing to be that kind of change? Yeah. Thomas Jefferson said that we only have the rights we're willing to fight for. Our Constitution gives all the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But for some children, the right to have two loving and involved parents in their lives has been usurped by the courts. Courts rule according to precedent, and the precedent has been biased against one parent in the past, branding him or her the non-custodial parent, which in itself is an insult. Equal parenting by two fit and willing parents is what our courts and agencies must go back to believing in. Laws and fiscal policies must not facilitate conflict and adversarial relationships between parents. It's only a matter of time before the civil rights of families will be restored in the courtrooms of our nation. Thank you.
Carol.
And that was Carol Rhodes talking about the child support system and family court. She is an insider, and she came out and she wrote a book called Friend of the Family, Enemy of the Court, where she outlined all the abuses within the child support system and the divorce industry. Really, it's a divorce industry. Coming up at 9:30, we're going to have Rick Neighbors and Tanner Faulkner on here talking about the opioid crisis in Congressional District 4, where Rick Neighbors is running against Adeholt, who has sat on his behind and is sitting somewhere, who knows where, with all these residences he has. But he's sitting on his behind as this thing outrages. Now, we got a couple of people on the line, but let's see who we got. Okay, who we have on the line?
Marcus, this is Rick Neighbors here. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You're a little bit early. Let's see who we got else on the line here. Okay, good morning. Who we got on the line?
This is Tanner Faulkner. They told us 8:50 to call them.
Yeah, we had some little issues with the timing. This board is set up. It's based out of another state, so there was a mistake when we put the time in, so sorry everybody for that mistake. But it's not the end of the world. We got this. I was just playing this because the Alabama Department of Human Resources, they're having a meeting. They've been meeting, you know, this past 2 years. They're changing some of the guidelines and things like that. And that's one of my passions that I also do is fight for people for equal justice in the family court system. And that relates to everything we're going to be talking about here. It relates to the opioid crisis, and it relates to a lot of people's, financial crisis. Like, you know, even though they didn't pass this HEROES Act, there is a lot of people who will not partake in this. So I can't see why they call it the HEROES Act. Yes, the proposed plans are going to help a lot of people, but people who owe back child support, they're acting like these people are not affected by COVID, you know, and we know that for every dollar that they take from a person who back to child support, the state gets $5.63. So when they take that $1,200 from a person, they take the $1,200 coming from the federal government, and then they get a kickback of $5.63 for every dollar they just collected. So it comes around to about $9,000, I guess. So what the number someone needs to add is how many people in Alabama that owed back child support had their stimulus checks taken. So you can take that number, multiply that number by $9,000, and that's just how much these Department of Human Resources just got kicked back from the government. Now, I don't think that's right. If they owe it, yes, get it. But why should they still get the 5-to-1 ratio? I don't think that's right. I think it needs to be looked at. And they at least can have some, non-custodial parents and people who owe back to child support have been beating down. They even took money from people that were disabled during COVID, during the pandemic. So it's just really nasty how the courts have gotten toward non-custodial parents. We need more programs to try to bring broken families back together. Too long have the courts been profiting off of broken families, and I don't think that's right. So we want to welcome these two guys here. We're going to talk about a very important issue. I don't know if they want to jump right in now, but we have 2 hours to get at this. We don't want to bore anybody, but first I want to introduce Rick Neighbors and let him tell us a little about himself and why he's running, and then we're going to hear from Tanner Faulkner right after that.
Good morning. My name is Rick Neighbors, Democratic nominee for the 4th Congressional District. Mark, it's good to be here. Tanner, I'm waiting to hear your story, which is a very common story throughout the 4th Congressional District. For those who may not be aware, when there are 435 congressional districts in this nation, in terms of median income, the 4th Congressional District is ranked 405 out of 435, meaning we are in the bottom 7% of all the congressional districts in the U.S. in terms of living standards. That feeds into, in part of the foundation of why we have so much despair within the 4th District. Now, let me also add why I'm here, which is I think is infuriating. Our current representative has been in office 24 years, has ignored this issue for the people in the 4th. Not only has he ignored this issue, he doesn't even live here. He lives in Arlington, Virginia, and he lives in the top 7% of the highest income districts in the nation. Folks, we have problems. And let me just share a story recently in Walker County. With drugs, this 30-year-old woman, for choices that were made or choices that weren't made, responding to things that she didn't understand, she lived in the woods in a tent for 3 years. Yes, she was a drug addict. Her conversations were with the animals that she could identify around her. She ended up getting caught for stealing to try to buy her drugs, and she was sent to a very, very fine rehab center that is a year-long program. This young lady has been exposed, number one, cleaned her out, but also she went to school, and she found out she was very smart, real smart. And now she's on her way to become a contributing citizen to her community. We need representations that folks who understand this and do from a governmental standpoint create those conditions where people are not led down to this path of hopelessness.
And that's why I like what you would. No, I'm sorry for interrupting. You just reminded me of a program. I don't know if you want to shout them out, but you were telling me about a program that sounded perfect for what you're saying. People need to be able to get back to a sense of normalcy. And hopefully you can tell more about that program, but we need somebody like you who support programs like that. I haven't heard nothing out of Adderhall and his team, what they really have dug in and tried to get a hold of. I mean, if he can go out and get hold of all these properties and lands, he should be able to go out there and get a hold of some type of program that could really address this issue.
The facility is the City of Light Stream Center in Door, Alabama. People doing good work. They're a charity, faith-based charity organization. But the stories of the ladies that have come through there and they are graduating. And it is funny, they call them clients and they come through the judicial system. Now, we need some reforms in our judicial system, absolutely. We need some reforms in our prison system, absolutely. But in this one regard, the judge is there, they have choices. You lock these people up, for what reason? No purpose, except that you turn back out and no solution. Nothing has changed. These are just people that still have no hope, no skills, and no job. What they're doing in the Dream Center, these folks come in, dry out, they go to school, they learn a trade. When they leave there, they have a job. They're trained for the job in the industry. They leave there, they have a home to go to under Section 8 home. And because we are 66% rural, and these folks get out of there, how do they get to work? Well, guess what? The good people of the district are donating cars that has been signed over to these women. So they get out, they got a home, they got a skill, they got transportation to get to and from work. This is a holistic approach for taking broken people and making them whole again. And in your previous speaker that I was listening to, it's about families, holistic families, where it does take a village to make a child. And we have left some of our people behind. But I'm very grateful that we had the facilities like the City Light String Center.
Yes, and what I like to see is groups like that networking with our elected officials. You got to work with these groups. You got to go out like you did. You got to see the work that they're doing and let you see the need. And then you can go back to the State House or D.C. You can go wherever and you can help craft programs and support these groups. A lot of these groups, especially during a time like here during COVID, a lot of these groups need the help right now at this crucial time, and they need a way to sustain themselves, because we know when we get in a crisis, these are the groups that we're going to turn to.
This conversation with the City of Light Stream Center started, Marcus, when I was following up on an article that was written a year ago about the opioid crisis in Walker County. And for folks that doesn't know, 4th Congressional District has the highest opioid prescription rate in the nation, and Walker County is one of the worst inflicted counties in the district. So I called these folks, and I wanted to know from them, had the opioid issue, as they were seeing, had changed from 2019 to 2020. And the response I got from the director has gotten worse.
Wow.
And she said, what has happened with COVID? You had what she called functioning addicts, people who get up, have kids in school, they go to work, and they come home, and then they start drinking at 8 o'clock at night. But with COVID, they were staying at home, no place to go, nothing to give them purpose, and they would start drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Also add to the 4th District, has one of the highest rates of death of despair. Deaths of despair are deaths due to drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And it goes back to the story Tanner will tell about the sense of purposelessness, hopelessness. And folks, you know, my value, and the value of most people, if you're hungry, I'm going to feed you. If you need help, I'm going to lend you a hand.
Right.
And
okay.
Not make you supportive all your life, but provide those skill sets that, so that you can become and will become a productive citizen. And we repeat this story over
and over again. So a person can get back to society and feel productive, because it's also an inside feeling. A lot of addiction, no matter whatever it is, has a lot to do with the inside feeling. And you could be trying to get yourself together, you know, struggling, dealing with addiction, but you could have sometimes unwittingly, unknowingly, family members and friends that come in and put you down instead of giving you the helping hand. So we're gonna take a quick break, just about a 2-minute break, and then we're gonna come back and we're gonna hear this young man's story. We're gonna hear from Tanner and let him tell us about what he experienced and the things that he can tell you about from firsthand knowledge. We'll be right back after this short about 2-minute break. And I'm gonna play the famous Orr Sisters. They're from Lawrence County. They're a gospel group. They're very good. They go on tour, and they have came out to events that I've held and been a part of. So I'm going to play them for about 2 minutes, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear from Tanner. But let's see. I think we have a phone call. Okay, new caller, you on? Are you listening, or you got a comment?
I'm on, and I'm listening.
Okay, just hold on a second. Yes, we're going to have a quick break, and we'll come right back after this. We'll be talking with Tanner Faulkner and Rick Neighbors. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and in this episode of Bringing Voices to Power, I've been talking with 4th Congressional District candidate Rick Neighbors, and we're also about to listen and talk to Tanner Faulkner, who's going to talk about opioid addiction, and he's going to give us a firsthand account. So, Tanner, you want to tell us, introduce yourself, and tell us your story?
Yes, this is Tanner. It's good morning, Mr. Eccles. Good morning, Mr. Nominee.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you all are safe and healthy today.
Yes, sir.
My name's Tanner Faulkner. I was born on July the 7th, 2001, just 2 months before the entire direction of our country would change. And what followed my birth was an immediate, we immediately jumped into war and immediately began a recession as soon as I was born. And my parents were caught in that recession. My grandparents were caught in that recession. And I think that that event, you know, them all losing their jobs, my dad's oil shop, the oil shop that employed him closed, and at this time I was still in diapers, and so this all happened rather quickly. The person who owned my teenage father's job, he passed away, and you know, because of the economic conditions, you know, there was no furthering that business, and that. That is when, that's my earliest recollections of seeing, you know, the effects of the economy on my parents. And, you know, I can remember vividly hearing, you know, them talk about the recession, but of course I had no idea what that was. But the opioid crisis took my mother, my father, and my sister. That just leaves me. And thankfully I never fell victim, to that crisis. But you know, they've all since been treated, to one degree or another. My father went through faith-based rehab. My sister went through legal rehab, you know, that she was court appointed. And she just graduated about 2 weeks ago. So, you know, it's affected me all the way up until thus far. And you know, finally, my family, everyone is back to normal again. But I wanted to come out today. You mentioned the Department of Human Resources. And, you know, I want to try to give voice to the people that I know who are still there, still in District 4, because it's a tough and unforgiving place to live when you don't have anything. My whole reason for wanting to, you know, talk about these personal things, and that, you know, I'm sure we'll get, you know, deeper into it, is to just kind of, you know, make known what really goes on, and you know, that, you know, DHR was my biggest fear all the way up, all the way through school. That was my biggest fear. My friends had encounters with these people and told me, you know, horror stories. And you know, I spent a lot of my growing up life you know, hiding from that government agency, you know, and so I kind of understand what it was like to, you know, live during in both the recession and you know, the opioid crisis, and I was in a position where I could do nothing but just watch what happened. And you know, within a handful of years, I lived with grandparents and was taken care of by them, and my parents weren't around much anymore. And you know, they were consumed by their addiction for almost 10 years, and that for that stretch of time they weren't around. You know, I know exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about this pandemic.
Okay, this is a question I always wanted to ask. Since you lived through both of the treatments, and I like to compare. Do you think it was better for a family member to go through a legal type of rehab or a faith-based rehab? Could you tell the difference of who we're getting?
It depends on who the person is. You know, sometimes an individual needs that extra push to, you know, get them to participate fully in the activities of a rehab. and commit themselves to that. So for someone like that who would be more reluctant, because my sister was the most reluctant, you know, for someone who's reluctant, it's best, you know, I'm sure for your court appointed. But my father had been out, you know, court, and my father, he went to a faith-based rehab. But his is a true story of changing, you know, your life. He's an electrician now, and he spent 10 years of his life, you know, wandering the streets. And my father, through faith-based rehab, completely changed his life. And so both are and can be effective. If someone already has a foundation, a religious foundation or some religious rapport, then I think a faith-based option would be the best. But if someone's reluctant to, you know, help themselves, then it's probably best to ask the judicial system.
Yeah, that's exactly true, and that's the answer I was looking for, because, you know, when you deal with a faith-based operation of rehabbing someone, you're showing love, you're showing compassion, and a lot of times just by the structure of it. When it's court ordered, it's like, you know, the man is right there standing over you, you know, so that adds a different dynamic. And I would always think of faith-based type of rehab programs who also need our support as well. I think those type of programs do best. Like you said, if you have that religious foundation and that welcoming nature of a faith-based program, that goes a long way. Okay, let me ask, in light of what Tanner just told us, Rick, what would you do as an elected congressperson when it comes to the opioid situation in District 4? What ideals do you have, and what's your stance and your overview of it? Because it is really out of control, out of control.
Well, the issues, you've got to look at root causes. Why are people find themselves in this situation? Yes, we can say people make choices, but people can only make choices amongst what they see their options are. And if you see that you don't have any options, then your choices become very limited, and sometimes those choices create hardship for yourself. But if you don't know, if you have no choice, and some choice gives you a sense of doing something, which ends up becoming an addict. What do we do? What is our obligation? Let me ask a question and try to answer my own particular question. What is the role of government? What is the role of government? What do we want government to do? Whether that be a local government, state government, or federal government. Well, to me, is to promote your general welfare. How do you promote your general welfare? Ultimately, it comes down to intent is to make people's lives better. Not that you're telling people what to do, but that you put options out there where they would move towards how they perceive their world is better. What we know, one constant in the 4th District is poverty. And when you're down as far as low as you can get, you don't have very many options, and you end up making bad choices. I heard a person running for district judge, re-election. He said that he was sentencing primarily black young men to jail. They come out of jail, get out of jail for a good time. They had no skill, no education, could not get a good job. They ended up doing something else, come back before him. He would sentence them again. They would get out for good behavior, could not find a job, had no skills, no education. They end up going back to jail. So his solution was to give them more jail time, because that's the only tool we gave this judge to work with, or he perceived it, is the sentence.
He has the tools.
We know that.
But we can't deny the power of the private prison system. There's a lot of money to be made in these prison systems. And then when you combine money to be made, because these states a lot of times be under contract to keep these prisons full, you combine that with a person that cutting all the programs. I remember people would get out of I remember people getting out of prison, and then when they get out of prison, they'd have a degree. They would be further than I was, and I was on the outside going to school part-time. They'd go do some years, they'd get out, and they got a degree in this, or they know how to do upholstery or barbering. They was learning some type of skill where they wouldn't have to go out and do some of the things that they do. But when they start cutting those in all those programs in prison to rehabilitate a person, isn't that's just, to me, that's just blatantly trying to create the recidivism. That's, you're trying to create that. These people get out, they can't get a job, they can't get housing, you know, and they're just so much at it, and they can't even vote anymore, so they can't affect the laws that are going to run their lives. It's a desperate situation, and we turning people out with no hope. Of course they're coming back.
That's a nonsense. It's nonsensical what we do. But then again, that goes back to the issue of judicial reform. You get a DA, and people may or may not know this, someone allegedly commits a crime, the DA has to go to a grand jury and say, hey, I think these people have harmed society. We need to do something. And the 99.9% of the time, the grand jury says, hey, district attorney, I agree with you. But what people don't know is the district attorney is not obligated to tell the grand jury the truth. He can tell them a lie, and they're protected in doing that. People don't know that district attorney is not obligated to give the grand jury members all the information. He can cherry pick that.
That is true.
When I talk about judicial reform, we need to change that. But they come back and say, reelect me. See, I'm protecting your streets. And that's nonsense. If the people are in jail because they don't have a skill and they can't do anything, and we put them back out on the street after taking away their liberty and they still have no skill, no education, can't get a job, how have we made our communities better? We have not.
You haven't. You've put that person in a desperate situation. I mean, if say a person went there for using drugs or dealing drugs, they get out and they meet those stressors. Those stressors is what's going to cause people to fall off the wagon. And when you do that, that's when you're going to have people, recommit crimes. They're going to recommit the crimes that got them in there most likely. And so when we get them out, what we got to have is have something for them. Already, we should be training them while they're in there. When they get out, they should have one leg up. They should have a skill. They could be certified in something. There's no reason we should put them in a cell for, 23, 24 hours a day and just leave them idle. That person could be, and you got online computers now, that person could be on a computer doing an online class, learning a skill where they don't have to return to the lifestyle they did before. Because we're starting to punish people for being addicted to drugs. And when you start doing that, you're not going to fix the problem. You're going to make the problem worse. Okay, we got a caller on the phone right before we went to Tanner that said they had a few questions. Caller, you on the line? You have questions for Tanner or you have questions for Rick or me, the host?
I have questions. For whoever is most prepared to answer the question, there is a comment I'd like to make first. One of the biggest problems with oxycodone and your addiction problems are in our prisons. So that's a big problem. We have a drug problem in our prison. The other thing is, don't forget that we have a three strike and you're out law. So now we're talking about long-term incarceration because someone got out on a small drug charge, did their time, came back out, couldn't find a job, wasn't prepared, has no rehabilitation skills, went back to jail because of another drug charge, and on the third time, he's sentenced to a life in prison. That's why our prisons are currently, you know, in woeful shape, like three times the number of inmates. So
much so that the feds threatening to come in and take them over.
That's right. And why do we think for-profit prisons would be a better solution for Alabama when they have to make a profit on top of running a prison?
$900 million worth? I mean, we can spend that on prisons, but we can't spend enough to rehab and give a lot of people have problems. They don't need to be punished for their problems. They need to be helped with their problems.
They need some help. And so that leads to my next question, and this is for Mr. Neighbors. Your opponent for District 4 has continually voted no for expansion of Medicaid, for expanding the state children's health insurance program, for expanding mental health treatments, to treating addictions of all sorts as a health issue. How would you address that problem of trying to help our citizens with their health care?
There's this quote: the problems we face cannot be solved with the same thinking that created them. Yes, the three strikes law and you're out was a mistake, and I think most people who follow that recognize that it has unintended consequences that is far beyond what the proposed benefit was. And for folks who don't know, they says, okay, the idea was to try to control drug use. It says, okay, these habitual offenders, we just lock them up. But going back to the caller's point and what the point we've been making, the people are in there, they made bad choices because of circumstance around them. Yes, they own their choice. But we did not solve anything. We just put them back out on the streets with no skills, no training, no job. And said, we have served society and we made society worse. Medicaid, the Medicaid expansion. If you go back to the Affordable Care Act, and that act was assuming that everybody would, if we're going to reduce our Medicare costs, by the way, which is at the highest of any industrialized nation, by almost double, because 38% of our health care dollars go to profits, not to help, not to make people better. And in Alabama, we chose not to expand that, which means we did not fund the Emergency Care Act to keep rural hospitals open. Therefore, our hospitals had to close up or reduce their services. Therefore, we have made people worse off than make them better. The government has not served their people well in this regard. Now, why do we do that as legislatures? Well, we're in this case because laws were made to put us in this case. How do you get out of it? First, you start by making laws that do not punish people, but you create the laws that incentivizes people working to make their communities better. Now, how do we do that? We sit there and we have conversations, just like what we're having now. We know our criminal, the three strikes and outlaw was wrong. It doesn't do any good except cost a lot of money, and as Mark was talking about, now it's gotten so big, governments can't afford it, and they're thinking that private industry can solve the problem, which it cannot. Only thing it's going to do is make people in their facilities worse off. I mean, it makes no sense. If we can't afford it on the public, how do we think a private industry is going to do? They're just going to lock them up and throw away the key, and they die, they die. And that's not the values have we, that's not an obligation to each other. So how do we do that? We start having conversations and start changing the laws.
And that's a good point, Rick, because on the ballot on November the 3rd is an amendment that addresses the first look at rewriting the Alabama Constitution. And it's not what we would want, you know, as a completed thing, but it's the foot in the door sort of step. So if we can get our legislators. Pardon?
No, I was just saying it really does need to be revisited.
Oh, yes. Anything written and amended since 1901 or something?
Right.
Yeah. Needs to be redone. Hello. But, you know, this is something that people need to be aware of. The amendments on the back of their ballots are critical. And
yeah,
we need to look carefully at that.
And there's also one on there about judges as well, too. Isn't one on there about term limits when it comes to the judges? Some very important amendments on there.
Mm-hmm. There are some really important amendments. And, yeah, I think we have to look at that because I believe it's our Christian duty to help those less fortunate than us, regardless of whether they're drug addicts or not, and regardless of whether they're citizens of the United States, and regardless of whether they're old and maybe considered no longer productive citizens of the United States. You know, there's an amendment on that ballot that says only an American citizen can vote in an election. Now, you guys tell me who can vote that's not an American citizen. Now, why do we need an amendment?
Because that's their foot in the door of keeping someone out down the long road. This is just like the first step in making the next move. It's very calculated. It sounds like you said, who can vote besides an American? But this is just telling and could give a glimpse into what nefarious could that bill be up to? What nefarious could it be used for once you establish that? Who could it hurt in the long run?
I absolutely agree with you, but I think there's one other purpose for that amendment, and that's the carrot. You know, I think that's an incentive to come out and vote, because otherwise those immigrants that are illegal immigrants are going to be voting for your elected officials. So that's a rally cry as well.
Right.
Even though they can't vote.
Even
right.
though they can't vote now. That's exactly right.
Okay, Rick, as we were just talking about, this is related also as well, and it's also being discussed, there's this medical cannabis or marijuana bill that has passed so far. I guess everybody has to meet and vote on it, but it passed overwhelmingly. I think we need to look at more studies in different states where different states are using medical cannabis to get people off of the opioids without all the side effects and addictions. And I think Alabama needs to wake up, come into the light, and look at the science. And we got UAB and we got Auburn, we got other places that we can verify this information, even though there's a long history for it, but we just need it done in-house, in-state. There is a lot of evidence that when cannabis, medical cannabis is available, opioid overdoses go down significantly, suicides decrease, and crime decreases in all these states across the boards in all communities, all up and down the line. And I think there's a lot of fear of it rather than recognition of the medical benefits. And especially at a time like this, you know, people are on a lot of the harder drugs for anxiety. And this very medically sound that cannabis, medical cannabis, has been used to reduce anxiety. So we're so quick to give people a Xanax, but we fear giving them this medical cannabis. And I don't understand how we can continue to do that when over 30 states have some form of medical.
Well, there are 33 states who have approved marijuana use in one form or another. I'm not a medical expert. I cannot speak to the medicinal benefits of this product. But I've read enough articles that the experts who are suggest, the physicians suggest, that there are at times a benefit for this. For me, let the medical profession recommend. We know it goes on. It has goes on. It's going on. And I remember years ago, let me tell this story, 40 years ago, when most of the counties in Alabama were dry. And this county, Franklin County I'm in, says, no, I'm not going to vote it to go wet because we'll have a bunch of drunk drivers on the road and throwing the beer cans out. The argument that this lady didn't understand, people are still drinking. They're just driving drunk longer distances. We tried to prohibit people back in with prohibition. Only thing we did was create a crime wave. How you motivate people to do things that benefit them is through incentives, not through punishments. We respond to incentives. And so rather than saying, I'm going to incarcerate 2/3 of the population, and by the way, we have more people incarcerated than I think 25% of the world's incarcerated people in this country. We only have less than 5% of the world's population, for those who don't know that. Create the through the legislative process, the incentives, where people will aspire to achieve and to dream and to become what they can envision. Rather than create a hostile environment where if you move a certain way, we will incarcerate you. And we need leaders, I think, that can articulate the vision that we want to aspire to become, rather than to chain the activities and the thought processes and the dreams of those that are less fortunate. And by the way, in the state of Alabama, our mobility rate is zero. Especially in the 4th Congressional District. What does that mean? That means if you're born poor in the 4th District, you will most likely die poor in the 4th District.
And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't have to be that way.
But when it comes to that particular subject we were just talking about, and at this time, we know with everything with being isolated, COVID, people are depressed, and some of the same things that this is supposed to help is the main reason why they should be moving on it. Now look how it passed. It passed very easily, but some of the things that some of the medical will help for the anxiety, the depression, the Crohn's disease, a lot of things that people are experiencing right now. You know, some of the things, the 15 conditions in Alabama, some of them is anxiety, autism, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, fibromyalgia, age-related weight loss, persistent nausea, post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a lot of veterans and people suffering post-traumatic stress disorder from just traumatic events in their life, sleep disorders, spastic movements, neuron disease. There's terminal illnesses. If we know, and they have passed the first leg of this, we know a lot of these symptoms are going to be aggravated by the times we're in, and we know this, and it's already passed in one leg of it, bipartisan. Why wait? Why stand at a standstill? Even if people are voting remotely, they should come in and things that's bipartisan and they agree on in Alabama, they should agree on it. I'm not against working across the aisle. When you put something forth and it gets bipartisan support like that, you should move it forward quickly. They've been sitting on this while people have been suffering and the opioid crisis increased. I know people who moved to other states, well, only two people, but both of them got off of the majority of their medication. Almost all of the pain pills are gone. And some of the other pills, they moved and got on it. We need to move on things that are bipartisan in Alabama. And Rick, just tell us, first of all, tell us how people can contact you and get in contact with your campaign and how they can help. And talk about also how you're willing to work across the aisle on things that benefit all of Alabama.
Okay, the website is neighborsforcongress.com. That's NEIGHBORS, the number four, congress.com. And we, as far as benefit, we have to have conversations. We've got to talk with each other. Last night I was in a city council meeting of a small community. And a shout out to all of our elected officials, and especially the local officials, the council members, the mayors, the county commissioners, because these are the folks that really tote the water. These are the folks that give meaning to the idea of liberty and democracy, because these are the ones that are making the decisions in their community. They make the decisions. The decisions that they make and the influence is the difference of whether we press the life out of a man on the ground or we aspire to the most lowly to reach extreme heights. And that comes from decisions made in the local community. How do we do that? We do that by sitting down and talking, not yelling, not screaming, just like we're talking here, and have conversations. And people of goodwill will make the best decisions they can at that moment in time. We just trust in each other and come with good faith to do good, and we will.
Okay, and I want to invite everybody to come out this weekend. We got an event set up at McKelvey Park on Rosenwald Street in Moulton, Alabama. There is an 80% chance of predicted rain, but people are going to bring tents. There is a gazebo. Now, we're going to keep a watch on this weather. Now, if it get bad, we're not going to ask anybody to put themselves in any type of physical jeopardy. But we're also talking about the week after that, October 17th, maybe going down to Red Bank, Alabama, the Red Bank Community Park there beside the fire station. Red Bank, you know, also known as Town Creek. And we hope to see you guys out there. Tanner, can you tell me, I always like to ask this and update this when I have people on talking about drugs and stuff. And one of my first broadcasts was about addiction. And I also have attended, you know, Auburn's Opioid Institute of training there. I got some certifications over there in Huntsville a few months back, earlier this summer. But could you tell parents something? I always ask the people who know about this, or somebody that's on the outside that don't do drugs, things that you know now that you see. Could you give parents or anybody the heads up of things to look for? Like, I'm going to give you an example. The young lady I had on my first show, she talked about how kids would sometimes hide their drugs at the bottom of the cereal box, you know, things like that. So parents, you know, could have an eye for things that they normally wouldn't look at. Advice you could give a parent or someone to notice?
It's a broad spectrum of individuals and how they exhibit their illness the things that they do. It differs person to person. The first thing that I think that you can recognize with someone who is, you know, not necessarily specific only to addiction, I think, you know, anytime a human being is battling with themselves, they're forced to become extremely withdrawn, you know, because there's no time for exterior interaction because they're fighting with their brain. And people who are drug addicts are still human beings. And, you know, the path where they get to where they're at, which is, you know, it's often dubbed rock bottom, but that path, while it is a series of poor decisions, it eventually becomes chemical mental slavery that they can't help. And so when people start withdrawing and start losing the attributes that make them a specific human, the things that, you know, my sister, when I knew her when I was a child,
you know, she was my very best friend. And then she withdrew so much through her teenage years. And then by the time she was in her early 20s, my sister was a full-blown, you know, heroin, meth, and drug addict. And that's what happened. And that's what happened, of course, with my parents, too. You know, they began to withdraw and then lost as individuals what made them who they were. And I mean that in every respect of the word. You know, they lost, you know, their dignity. They lost their appearance. They lost everything.
And that, studying psychology, that's what I've learned, too. Some of that is, like you said, when they lose their dignity, some of that they withdraw because they are ashamed. They might tell you, no, I'm not on drugs, but they're withdrawing because they are ashamed that they know that you know. So once a person, you know, is like that, they are at a reachable point when they're like that, because if they are, the withdrawal is some of the shame. That's when they really need that contact and that support at that moment.
Right. And I don't think any, you know, and that we make a grave mistake when we talk about this pandemic that destroys homes, destroys, you know, it can infect a company even. And, you know, especially, you know, where people are making minimum wage, or, you know, or less than 15 or so dollars an hour, drug usage can literally infect, you know, entire shifts at work. But we're in my opinion, we're at an extraordinary time right now. We're at a time where none of us are at our best, where none of us are as sharp as we always were, where none of us know, you know, the conditions of which we're living. You know, the President of the United States hasn't been honest. He hasn't been honest with us about this virus. So just like those, you know, just like those people who we have easily forgotten with the name opioid, because, you know, opioid doesn't go in, that word doesn't say mother, father, sister, brother, nephew, aunt, uncle. You know, opioid doesn't tell you that it affects minorities worse than anyone else in this country. You know, that one little word is easy to shrug off. But right now, we're at an extraordinary time. We're at a time where we are having to recover together. And the next four legislative years are so pivotal and so important. And District 4 needs Rick Neighbors through that. And because the next 4 years is going to be a facilitation of growth. And, of course, you know, that's a two-year elected position. But I say that with, you know, the fact that if he won, he would definitely be reelected. But we are going to have to rebuild and regrow, you know, from this. And we're recovering together. And so this is where we as a nation can, you know, just like we're having to face this coronavirus, which is full of uncertainty, it's full of, you know, it's a dark wilderness, and we don't even know what's on the other side. And the opioid crisis has been viewed as the same way, you know, since the 1980s, since Nancy Reagan's war on drugs. And Nancy Reagan's completely ineffective war on drugs, the DARE line went and seen both of my parents, but it didn't stop a thing. The line didn't save anything. And, you know, of course, I was visited by the line. But, you know, it just, this is societal. And we can solve this together, and it's going to take, you know, it's going to take us all being knocked down a few levels, so that we can, you know, recognize these people's humanity, because there's humanity in those people walking on the streets. There's humanity, you know, in those poor children. And you asked me to say something to, you know, parents to look out for. But if I could, I would like to say something to those children that are there.
Oh,
because, And I remember living in such a level of hopelessness because I watched the rapid deterioration of so many of my family members at such a young age. Today I work, I study and work in death care, taking care of deceased people. And, you know, that's a passion and a calling of mine. I'm not actively involved at this time, but, it's what I finished a year towards the degree. But, I've had to stop due to coronavirus. But to watch people rapidly deteriorate at a young age, it kind of helps you prepare for the end and helps you prepare people for the end. And so that's what I spend every day doing because of the opioid crisis, because I had to bury so many. I had to say goodbye to so many. But to those children, and I know that the level of hopelessness is something that you can't explain, because anybody you tell, it can be dangerous and you could be taken, and you risk the chance that you're going to be somewhere way worse than where you're at, even though you know it's not satisfactory. And to those children, I would say, joy comes in the morning. Do not fret. And, there's a silver lining. There's a way to make it out. There's a way to, separate yourself from that behavior. And you will be told so many times in your life that you are a product of your parents and that you'll never be more than your parents. I've heard it from school teachers that taught one of both of my parents, tell me, that I'm going to be just like them, and I was in middle school. And you are labeled for the rest of your life as, a junkie's kid, and that's something that I've taken as a term of endearment, because both of my parents have rerouted their life and they're both productive tax-paying citizens in this society.
And that's another reason, not only just with people who have been on drugs and recovery, just with anybody. Don't let anybody label you, put you in a box, or try to constrain you or tell you that you can't do great things. But with that, I just want to say we're coming up to the end of the show, and I want to appreciate y'all calling. We got to have y'all back, and I'm doing a story Thursday, maybe around this time, and I'll let you guys know if Rick and Tanner, if y'all want to come back. This lady wants to tell her story. She lost her son due to opioid addiction, and she's just now starting to, talk about it. I've been talking with her for a while now. She's just now getting, a little strong enough to tell her story, but she wants to come on and tell what happened to her, and it's in the Athens area. So it's really a deep story, and I want to encourage everybody to come back and listen to that. Rick, you want to say anything about where you're going to be next, where people can see you, talk to you, and just what you would have people doing right now?
Well, Marcus will be in, as you said, in Lawrence County in Moulton at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and I encourage everyone to come out. Folks, this is an important, of course, it's a cliche, it's an important election. But if we want something different, we got to do something different. If we want something different in the fourth, and you've been there 24 years and you hadn't made a change, I don't expect another term will show any difference for the people of the fourth district. We don't have to live the way we're living. We're living because we've got self-serving career politicians and making it this way. Let's change that.
Yes. Yes. And with that, I'm going to play a song for y'all, Tanner. I'm going to play a song for y'all. This is, again, the famous Orr Sisters. They're a gospel group here in Lawrence County, in the city of Courtland, Alabama. It's a really good, it's a family group. They've been putting out music for many, many years. They really, know how to bring some good gospel music. So I'm going to play that. And then with that, we hope to see y'all Thursday around the same time, I think, but I'll be contacting Linda, if you guys want to call in and hear her story, and sort of it's like talking with Rick, sort of is like a counseling session when it comes to issues like this. When you can talk about issues like this with a Rick Neighbors? Could you see Etterholt sitting down and having a heart-to-heart conversation and hearing people pain like Tanner has felt? Can you imagine Etterholt being able to sit there? I can't. So I'm going to play this here for y'all, and we'll get back and we'll finish this conversation. Just because Etterholt has ignored you, you don't have to, you know, go that route anymore. You can get somebody in there like Rick who doesn't mind talking to everyday people and hearing their problems and discussing ways to solve it.